Well, for all we know. I meet his gaze. You were right, she's biased. But she doesn't think she is, and she doesn't want to be seen that way. So maybe, just maybe, it'll swing in our favor. Howard looks at me for a long second. I can tell he wants to speak his mind, but he just nods. You're the boss, he says. We accept juror number 12, I tell the judge. I'd like to strike juror number 2, Odette continues. That is my black security guard, my perfect 10. Odette knows this, which is why she is willing to use a peremptory strike against him. But I am up like a shot before she even finishes her sentence. Your Honor, sidebar. We approach the bench. Judge, I say, this is a blatant violation of Batson. James Batson was an African-American man who was tried for burglary in Kentucky by an all-white jury. During the voir dire phase of the trial, when the jurors were being selected, the prosecutor used peremptory strikes against 6 potential jurors, 4 of whom were black. The defense tried to discharge the jury on the grounds that Batson was not being tried by a representative sample of the community, but the judge denied it, and Batson wound up being convicted. In 1986, the Supreme Court ruled in Batson's favor, stating that a prosecutor's use of peremptory strikes in a criminal case could not be based solely on race. Since then, any time a black person gets bounced from a jury, any defense attorney worth his or her salt will cry Batson. Your Honor, I continue, the Sixth Amendment guarantees the right of a defendant to be tried by a jury of his or her peers. Thank you, Ms. McQuarrie. I know very well what the Sixth Amendment says. I didn't mean to imply otherwise. New Haven is a very diverse county, and the jury needs to reflect that diversity. And right now, this gentleman is the only black juror in this pool of 14. You have got to be kidding, Odette says. You're saying I'm racist? No, I'm saying that it's a lot easier for you to stack a jury in the state's favor without being called on it because of your race. The judge turns to Odette. What's your reason for exercising your peremptory strike, counselor? I found him argumentative, she says. This is the first group of jurors, Judge Thunder warns me. Don't get your knickers in a twist. Maybe it's the fact that he is so blatantly favoring the prosecution right now. Maybe it is that I want to show Ruth I am going to bat for her. Maybe it's just because he used the word knickers and it made me remember my steroid rant against him. But for whatever reason, or maybe all of them, I straighten my spine and take this opportunity to unbalance Odette before we even get started. I want a hearing on this, I demand. I want Odette to produce her notes. We had other argumentative people on this panel, and I want to know if she documented that characteristic for the other jurors. Rolling her eyes, Odette climbs into the witness box. I have to admit, there's enough public defender pride in me to love seeing a prosecutor in there, effectively caged. She glares at me as I approach. You indicated that juror number 2 was argumentative. Did you listen to the responses of juror number 7? Of course I did. How did you find his demeanor? I ask. I found him friendly. I looked down at Howard's excellent notes. Even when you asked him about African Americans and crime, and he came out of his seat and said you were implying he was a racist? Is that not argumentative? Odette shrugs. His tone was different than juror number 2's. Coincidentally, so was his skin color, I say. Tell me, did you make any notes about juror number 11 being argumentative? She glances down at her chart. We were moving quickly. I didn't write down everything I was thinking because it wasn't important. Because it wasn't important, I clarify. Or because that juror was white? I turn to the judge. Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Thunder turns to the prosecutor.
I am not going to allow the peremptory challenge. You're not getting me into a Batson situation this early in the game, Ms. Lawton. Juror number 2 remains on the panel.
I slide into my seat beside Ruth, pretty damn pumped. Howard is blinking at me like I'm a goddess. It's not every day you get to school a prosecutor. Suddenly, Ruth passes a note to me. I unfold it, read the two simple words. Thank you. When the judge dismisses us for the day, I tell Howard to go home and get some sleep. Ruth and I leave the courthouse together. I peek outside first to make sure that the coast is clear of media. It is, but I know that will change as soon as we start the trial. When we reach the parking lot, however, neither one of us seems to be in a great hurry to leave. Ruth keeps her head ducked, and I know her well enough by now to know that something's on her mind. You want to go grab a glass of wine? Or do you have to get back to Edison? She shakes her head. He's out more than I am these days. You don't sound thrilled about that. Right now, I'm not exactly his role model, Ruth says. We walk around the corner to a bar that I've been to many times before, celebrating victory or drowning defeat. It's full of lawyers, I know, so I squirrel us into a booth way in the back. We both order Pinot Noir, and when the glasses arrive, I toast. Here's to an acquittal. I notice Ruth doesn't lift her glass. Ruth, I say gently, I know this was the first time you've been in court, but trust me, today went really, really well. She swirls the wine in her glass. My mama used to tell a story about how once she was pushing me in a stroller in our neighborhood in Harlem, and two black ladies passed her. One of them said to the other, "She walking around like that her baby. That ain't her baby. I hate when nannies do that." I was light-skinned compared to Mama. She laughed it off because she knew the truth. I was hers through and through. But the thing is, growing up, it wasn't the white kids who made me feel worst about myself. It was the black kids. Ruth looks up at me. That prosecutor made it all come flooding back today, like she was out to get me. I don't know if it's all that personal for Odette. She just likes to win. It strikes me that this is a conversation I have never had with someone who is African American. Usually I am so conscious of not being seen as prejudiced that I would be paralyzed by the fear of saying something that would be offensive. I've had African American clients before. But in those cases, I was very clearly setting myself up to be the one with all the answers. Ruth has seen that mask slip. With Ruth, I know I can ask a stupid white girl question, and that she will answer me without judging my ignorance. Likewise, if I step on her toes, she'll tell me so. I think about the time she explained to me the difference between weaves and extensions, or how she asked me about sunburn and how long it takes for blistered skin to start peeling. It's the difference between dancing along the eggshell crust of acquaintance and diving into the messy center of a relationship. It's not always perfect. It's not always pleasant. But because it is rooted in respect, it is unshakable. You surprised me today, Ruth admits. I laugh. Because I'm actually good at what I do? No, because half the questions you asked were based on race. She meets my gaze. After all this time telling me that doesn't happen in a courtroom. It doesn't, I say bluntly. Come Monday, when the trial starts, everything changes. You'll still let me speak? Ruth confirms. Because I need to say my piece. I promise. I set my wine glass down. Ruth, you know, just because we pretend racism has nothing to do with the case doesn't mean we aren't aware of it. Then why pretend? Because it's what lawyers do. I lie for a living. If I thought it was going to get you acquitted, I could tell the jury that Davis Bauer was a werewolf. And if they believe me, shame on them. Ruth's eyes meet mine. It's a distraction. It's a clown waving in your face, so you don't notice the sleight of hand going on behind him. It's strange to hear my work described that way, but it's not entirely untrue. Then I guess all we can do is drink to forget. I lift my glass. Ruth finally takes a sip of her wine. There isn't enough Pinot Noir in the world, I run my thumb around the edge of my cocktail napkin.
Do you think there will ever be a time when racism doesn't exist?
No.
Because that means white people would have to buy into being equal. Who'd choose to dismantle the system that makes them special?
Heat floods my neck.
Is she talking about me? Is she suggesting that the reason I won't buck the system is because I, personally, have something to lose?
But then, Ruth muses, maybe I'm wrong.
I lift my glass, clink it against hers. To baby steps, I toast. After one more day of jury selection, we have our 12 plus 2 alternates. I spend the weekend holed up in my office, preparing for Monday's opening arguments of the trial, taking off only Sunday afternoon to meet the neonatologist. Micah met Ivan Kelly Garcia in his freshman orgo class, when, during the midterm, Ivan rushed in with only a half hour left during the exam, dressed like a giant hot dog, grabbed an exam booklet, and aced the test. The previous night was Halloween, and he'd passed out drunk in a sorority house and woke up to realize he was about to forego his entire future as a doctor. Ivan not only went on to become Micah's study partner in Orgo, but also to go to Harvard Med and become one of the best neonatologists in the tri-state area. He is thrilled to hear from Micah after so many years, and he's even outwardly thrilled to host his insane lawyer wife and one very crabby four-year-old who should not have been awakened from her car seat nap. Ivan lives in Westport, Connecticut, in a sedate colonial, with his wife, a woman who managed to make homemade guacamole and salsa for us after her 15-mile morning marathon training run. They don't have any kids yet, but they do have a giant Bernese mountain dog, which is currently either babysitting Violet or licking her to death.
Look at us, bro, Ivan says. Married, employed, sober. Remember that time we dropped acid and I decided to climb a tree but forgot I'm scared of heights?
I look at Micah. You dropped acid?
You probably didn't tell her about Sweden either,
Ivan muses. Sweden? I look between the two men.
Cone of silence, Ivan says. Bro code.
The thought of Micah, who prefers his boxer shorts ironed, as a bro makes me stifle a laugh.
My wife's trying her first murder case,
Micah segues smoothly.
So I apologize in advance if she asks you 10,000 questions.
Under my breath, I whisper, I'm totally getting that whole story from you later. Then I smile at Ivan. I was hoping you could explain newborn screening.
Well, basically, it was a game changer for infant mortality, thanks to something called tandem mass spectrometry, which is done at the state lab. We can identify a handful of congenital diseases that can be treated or managed. I'm sure your daughter had it done, and you probably were never the wiser.
What kinds of diseases? I ask.
Oh, a whole science nerd dictionary. Biotinidase deficiency. That's when the body can't reuse and recycle enough free biotin.
Congenital adrenal hyperplasia and congenital hypothyroidism, which are hormone deficiencies. Galactosemia, which prevents an infant from processing a certain sugar that's in milk, breast milk, and formula. Hemoglobinopathies, which are problems with red blood cells. Amino acid disorders, which cause amino acids to build up in the blood or the urine, and fatty acid oxidization disorders, which keep bodies from turning fat into energy, and organic aciduria disorders, which are sort of a hybrid between the two. You've probably heard of some of them, like sickle cell, which affects a lot of African Americans, or PKU, Ivan says. Babies who have that one can't break down certain types of amino acids, and they build up in the blood or the urine. If you don't know your kid has the disease, it leads to cognitive impairment and seizures. But if it's flagged right after birth, it can be managed with a special diet, and prognosis is excellent.
I hand him the lab results. The lab says there was an abnormality in this patient's newborn screening.
He flips through the first few pages.
Bingo. This kid has MCADD, You can tell by the spikes on the mass spectrometry graph here at C6 and C8. That's the acyl-carnitine profile.
Ivan looks up at us.
Oh, okay, yeah, English. Well, the acronym is short for medium-chain acyl-coenzyme A dehydrogenase deficiency. It's an autosomal recessive disorder of fatty acid oxidation. Your body needs energy to do stuff. Move, function, digest, even breathe. We get our fuel from food and store it in our tissues as fatty acids until we need it. At that point, we oxidize those fatty acids to create energy for bodily functions. But a baby with a fatty acid oxidation disorder can't do that because he's missing a key enzyme. In this case, MCADD. That means once his energy stores are depleted, he's in trouble.
Meaning, he hands me back the packet.
His blood sugar will tank, and he will be tired, sluggish.
Those words trigger a flag in my mind. Davis Bauer's low blood sugar was blamed on his mother's gestational diabetes. But what if that wasn't the case? Could it cause death?
If it's not diagnosed early. A lot of these kids are asymptomatic until something acts like a trigger. An infection, or an immunization, or fasting. Then you get a rapid decline that looks an awful lot like sudden infant death syndrome. Basically, the baby goes into arrest.
Could a baby who arrests still be saved if he has MCADD?
It really depends on the situation. Maybe, maybe not.
Maybe, I think, is an excellent word for a jury. Ivan looks at me.
I'm guessing, if there's a lawsuit involved, that the patient didn't make it.
I shake my head. He died when he was 3 days old.
What day was the kid born?
Thursday. The heel stick was done on a Friday.
What time was it sent off to the state lab?
Ivan asks. I don't know, I admit. Does that make a difference?
Yeah.
He leans back in his chair, eyeing Violet, who is now trying to ride the dog.
The lab in Connecticut is closed on Saturday and Sunday. If the screening sample was sent out from the hospital after, say, midday on Friday, it didn't reach the lab till after the weekend.
Ivan looks at me.
Which means if this kid had been born on a Monday instead, he would have had a fighting chance.
Stage 2. Pushing. She wanted to get at the hate of them all, to pry at it, and work at it until she found a little chink, and then pull out a pebble, or a stone, or a brick, and then a part of the wall, and once started, the whole edifice might roar down and be done away with. Ray Bradbury, The Illustrated Man. Ruth. We all do it, you know. Distract ourselves from noticing how time's passing. We throw ourselves into our jobs. We focus on keeping the blight off our tomato plants. We fill up our gas tanks and top off our metro cards and do the grocery shopping so that the weeks look the same on the surface. And then one day, you turn around, and your baby is a man. One day, you look in the mirror and see gray hair. One day, you realize there is less of your life left than what you've already lived. And you think, how did this happen so fast? It was only yesterday when I was having my first legal drink, when I was diapering him, when I was young. When this realization hits, you start doing the math. How much time do I have left? How much can I fit into that small space? Some of us let this realization guide us, I guess. We book trips to Tibet. We learn how to sculpt. We skydive. We try to pretend it's not almost over. But some of us just fill up our gas tanks and top off our metro cards and do the grocery shopping. Because if you only see the path that's right ahead of you, you don't obsess over when the cliff might drop off. Some of us never learn. And some of us learn earlier than others. On the morning of the trial, I knock softly on Edison's door. You almost ready? I ask. And when he doesn't answer, I turn the knob and step inside. Edison is buried under a pile of quilts, his arm flung over his eyes. Edison, I say more loudly. Come on, we can't be late. He's not asleep. I can tell by the depth of his breathing. I'm not going, he mutters. Kennedy had requested that Edison miss school and attend the trial. I didn't tell her that these days going to school has been less of a priority for him, as evidenced by the number of times I've been called about him skipping class. I've pleaded, I've argued, but getting him to listen to me has become a Herculean task. My scholar, my serious sweet boy, is now a rebel. Holed up in his room, listening to music so loud it makes the walls shake, or texting friends I did not know he had. Coming home past curfew, smelling of hard liquor and weed. I have fought, I have cried, and now I'm not sure what else to do. The whole train of our lives is in the process of derailing, and this is only one of the cars skidding off the tracks. We talked about this, I tell him. No, we didn't, he squints at me. You talked at me. Kennedy says that someone who's seen as maternal is harder to picture as a murderer. She says that the picture you present to the jury is sometimes more important than the evidence. Kennedy says, you talk like she's Jesus. She is, I interrupt. At least she is right now. All my prayers are going to her because she is the only thing that stands between me and a conviction, Edison, which is why I am asking, no, begging you to do this one thing for me. I got stuff to do. I arch a brow. Like what? Skip school? Edison rolls away from me. Why don't you just leave? In about a week, I snap. Your wish might just come true. The truth has teeth. I hold my hand over my mouth, like I could will back the words. Edison fights to blink back tears. I didn't mean that, he mumbles. I know. I don't want to go to the trial because I don't think I can listen to what they say about you, he confesses. I put my hands on either side of his face. Edison, you know me. They don't. No matter what you hear in that courtroom, no matter what lies they try to tell you, you remember that everything I have ever done has been for you. I cup his cheek, follow the track of a tear with the pad of my thumb. You are going to make something of yourself. People are going to know your name. I can hear the echo of my mama telling me the same thing. Be careful what you wish for, I think. After today, people will know my name, but not for the reason she had hoped. What happens to you matters, I tell Edison. What happens to me doesn't. His hand comes up, encircling my wrist. It matters to me. Oh, there you are, I think, as I look into Edison's eyes. This is the boy I know, the boy I hooked my star on. It seems, I say lightly, that I am in need of a date to my own trial. Edison lets go of my wrist. He holds out his arm, crooked at the elbow, old-fashioned and courtly, even though he is still wearing his pajamas, even though I have a scarf wrapped around my hair, even though this is not a ball we are attending, but more of a gauntlet to run. It would be my pleasure, he says. Last night Kennedy had showed up at my house unexpected. Her husband and daughter were with her. She had come straight from some town about 2 hours away and was bursting to share her news with me. MCADD had shown up in Davis Bauer's newborn screening. I stared at the results she showed me, the same ones a doctor friend of her husband's had explained to her. But that's lucky, she finished. For you, anyway. I don't know if these results were missing from the file accidentally, or if someone tanked them purposely because they knew it would make you less culpable. But what's important is that we have the information now, and we're going to ride it to an acquittal. MCADD is a much more dangerous medical condition than a grade 1 patent ductus, the heart ailment Kennedy had planned to raise. It is not a lie anymore to say that the Bauer baby had had a life-threatening disorder. She wouldn't be lying in court. Just me. I had tried a half dozen times to come clean to Kennedy, especially as our relationship shifted from a professional track into a personal one. But as it had turned out, That just made it worse. At first, I couldn't tell her that I had intervened and touched Davis Bauer when he was seizing because I didn't know if I could trust her or how the truth would reflect on my case. But now I couldn't tell her because I was ashamed to have ever lied in the first place. I burst into tears. "Those better be tears of happiness," she said, "or gratitude for my remarkable legal talent." "That poor baby," I managed. "It's so arbitrary." But I wasn't crying for Davis Bauer, and I wasn't crying because of my own dishonesty. I was crying because Kennedy had been right all along. It didn't really matter if the nurse attending to Davis Bauer was black or white or purple. It didn't matter if I tried to resuscitate that baby or not. None of it would have made a difference. She put her hand on my arm. "Ruth," Kennedy reminded me, "bad things happen to good people every day." My cell phone rings just as the bus pulls up to our stop downtown. Edison and I step off as Adisa's voice fills my ear. "Girl, you're not gonna believe this. Where you at?" I look at a sign. "College Street." "Well, walk toward the green." I get my bearings, turning with Edison in tow. The courthouse stands a block away from the public park, and Kennedy has given me express directions not to approach from this direction, because I will be bombarded by press. But surely it can't hurt to see what's going on from a distance. I hear them before I see them, their strong voices braided together in harmony and climbing to the sky like Jack's beanstalk, aimed for heaven. It is a sea of faces, so many shades of brown singing, "Oh, freedom." In the front, on a small makeshift dais with a network logo backdrop behind him, is Wallace Mercy. Police form a human barrier, their arms outstretched, as if they are trying to cast a spell to prevent violence. Meanwhile, Elm Street itself is lined with news vans, their dishes craned to the sun, while reporters clutch their microphones with their backs to the green, and cameramen film a stream of footage. "My God," I breathe. "I didn't have anything to do with it, but that's for you," Adisa says proudly. "You should march right up those front steps with your head held high." "I can't. Kennedy and I have a prearranged meeting spot." "Okay," Adisa says, but I can hear the disappointment in her voice. "I'll see you in there," I tell her. "And Adisa, thanks for coming." She tisks. "Where else would I be?" she says. And then the line goes dead. Edison and I wander past oblivious Yale students, wearing backpacks like tortoise shells, past the gothic buildings of the residential colleges that are safely walled off behind black gates, past the poetry lady, the homeless woman who will recite a few lines for a donation. When we reach the parish house on Wall Street, we slip behind the building unnoticed into an empty lot. "Now what?" Edison asks. He's wearing the suit he wore to Mama's funeral. On any other day, he might be a boy going to a college interview. "Now we wait," I tell him. Kennedy has a plan to sneak me into the back entrance, where I won't attract media attention. She's asked me to trust her. Fool that I am, I do.
Turk. Last night, when I couldn't fall asleep, I watched some cable show that was on at 3 a.m. about how Indians used to live. They showed a reenactment, a dude in a loincloth, setting fire to a pile of leaves on the long line of a tree that had been split lengthwise. Then after it burned, he scraped it out with what looked like a clamshell, repeating the process until the canoe was hollowed out. That's what I feel like, today, like someone has rubbed me raw from the inside, until I'm empty. It's kind of surprising because I've been waiting so long for today. I thought for sure I'd have the energy of Superman. I was going to war for my son, and nothing was going to stop me. But strangely, I have a sense that I've reached the combat zone and found it deserted. I'm tired. I'm 25 years old and I have lived enough for 10 men. Britt comes out of the bathroom. "All yours," she says. She's wearing a bra and her pantyhose, which the prosecutor told her to wear, so that she looks conservative. And you, she suggested, should wear a hat. Fuck that. As far as I'm concerned, this is the memorial my son deserves. If I cannot have him back, I will make sure the people responsible for it are punished, and that others like them are left trembling with fear. I run the hot water and hold my hands under the faucet. Then I lather up with shaving cream. I rub this all over my scalp and start to use my straight edge to scrape my head smooth. Maybe it's the fact that I could not sleep, or I suppose the crater that's taken up residence inside me is making me shaky. For whatever reason, I nick myself just above the left ear. It stings like a mother as the soap runs into the cut. I press a washcloth against my head, but scalp wounds take a little while to clot. After a minute, I just let go, watch the streak of blood run down my neck, under my collar. It looks like a red flag coming from my swastika tattoo. I'm mesmerized by the combination. The white soap, the pale skin, the vivid stain. First, we drive in the opposite direction of the courthouse. There's frost on the front windshield of the pickup, and it's sunny. The kind of day that looks perfect until you realize how cold it is when you step outside. We are dressed up, me in the suit jacket that Francis and I share, and Britt in a black dress that used to hug her body and that now hangs on it. We are the only car in the lot. After I park, I get out and come around to Britt's side. This is not because I'm such a gentleman, but because she won't get out. I kneel down beside her, put my hand on her knee. "It's okay," I say. "We can lean on each other." She juts out her chin like I've seen her do when she thinks someone is about to dismiss her as weak or ineffective. Then she unfolds herself in the truck. She's wearing flat shoes the way Odette Lawton told her to, but her coat is short and only reaches to the hip, and I can tell the wind whips through the fabric of her dress fast. I try to stand between her and the gusts, as if I could change up the weather for her. When we get there, the sun is just hitting the headstone in a way that makes it sparkle. It's white. Blinding white. Britt bends down and traces the letters of Davis's name. The day of his birth, the hopscotch leap to his death, and just one word under that. Love. Britt had wanted it to say loved. Those were the directions she gave me for the granite carver, but at the last minute I changed it. I was never going to stop, so why make it past tense? I told Britt the carver had been the one to screw up. I didn't admit it had been my idea all along. I like the idea that a word on my son's grave matches the tattoo on the knuckles of my left hand. It's like I carry him with me. We stand at the grave until Britt gets too cold. There's a peach fuzz of lawn seeded after the funeral, already brown. A second death. The first things I see at the courthouse are the niggers. It's like the whole park in the middle of New Haven is covered with them. They're waving flags and singing hymns. It's that asshole from television, Wallace something, the one who thinks he's a reverend and probably got ordained online for $5. He's giving some kind of nigger history lesson talking about Bacon's Rebellion.
"In response, my brothers and sisters," he says, "whites and blacks were separated. If they united, it was believed they could do too much damage together. And by 1705, indentured servants who were Christian and white were given land, guns, food, money. Those who were not were enslaved. Our land and livestock was taken. Our arms were taken. If we lifted a hand to a white man, our very lives could be taken." He raises his arms. "History is told by Americans of Anglo descent."
Damn straight. I look at the size of the crowd listening to him. I think of the Alamo, where a handful of Texans held off an army of Spics for 12 days. I mean, they lost, but still. Suddenly, out of the sea of black, I see a white fist raised, a symbol. The crowd shifts as the man walks toward me. A big dude with a bald head and a long red beard. He stops in front of me and Britt and holds out his hand.
"Carl Thorildsen," he says, introducing himself. "But you know me as Odin 45.
It is the handle of a frequent poster on lonewolf.org. His companion shakes my hand, too. Eric Duval, White Devil. They are joined by a woman with twins, little silver-haired toddlers each balanced on a hip, then a dude in camo, three girls with heavy black eyeliner, a tall man in combat boots with a toothpick clenched between his teeth, a young guy with thick-framed hipster glasses and a laptop in his arms. A steady stream closes ranks around me, people I know by a shared interest in lonewolf.org. They are tailors and accountants and teachers. They are minutemen patrolling the borders in Arizona and militia in the hills of New Hampshire. They are neo-Nazis who never decredited. They have been anonymous, hiding behind the screens of usernames. Until now. For my son, they're willing to be outed once again.
Kennedy. On the morning of the trial, I oversleep. I shoot out of bed like a cannonball, throwing water on my face and yanking my hair into a bun at the nape and stuffing myself into my pantyhose and my best navy trial suit. Literally 3 minutes of grooming and I'm in the kitchen, where Micah is standing at the stove. "Why didn't you wake me up?" I demand. He smiles and gives me a quick kiss.
"I love you too, moon of my life," he says. "Go sit down next to Violet."
Our daughter is at the table, looking at me.
"Mommy, you're wearing two different shoes."
"Oh, God," I mutter, pivoting to go back to the bedroom. But Micah grabs my shoulder and steers me to a seat.
"You're going to eat this while it's hot. You need energy to take down a skinhead and his wife. Otherwise, you're going to run out of steam. And I know from personal experience that the only option for food in that courthouse is something brown they are trying to pass off as coffee and a vending machine of granola bars from the Jurassic period."
He puts down a plate. Two fried eggs, toast with jam, even hash browns. I am so hungry that I've already finished the eggs before he can set down the last of my breakfast. A steaming latte in his old Harvard med school mug.
"Look," he jokes, "I even served you your coffee in the white privilege cup."
I burst out laughing. "Then I'll take it with me in the car for luck. Or guilt. Or something." I kiss Violet on the crown of her head and grab my matching shoe from the bedroom closet, along with my phone, charger, computer, and briefcase. Micah's waiting for me at the door with the mug of coffee.
"In all seriousness, I'm proud of you."
I let myself have this one moment. "Thanks."
"Go forth and be Marcia Clark."
I wince. She's a prosecutor. "Can I be Gloria Allred?" Micah shrugs.
"Just knock 'em dead."
I am already walking toward the driveway. "Pretty sure that's the last thing you're supposed to say to someone who's about to try her first murder case," I reply. And I slip into the driver's seat, without spilling a drop of my coffee. I mean, that's got to be a sign, right? I drive around the front of the courthouse just to see what's happening, even though I've arranged to meet Ruth somewhere I know she won't be accosted. A circus, that's really the only way to describe it. On one end of the green, Wallace freaking Mercy is broadcasting live, preaching to a crowd through a megaphone.
"In 1691, the word white was used in court for the first time. Back then, this nation went by the one-drop rule,"
I hear him say.
"You needed only one drop of blood to be considered black in this country."
On the other end of the green is a cluster of white people. At first, I think they are watching Wallace's shenanigans, and then I see one hoisting the picture of the dead baby. They begin to march through the group that is listening to Wallace. There are curses, shoving, a punch thrown. The police immediately join the fray, pushing the blacks and the whites apart. It makes me think of a magic trick I did last year to impress Violet. I poured water into a pie pan and dusted the top with pepper. Then I told her the pepper was afraid of ivory soap. And sure enough, when I dipped the bar of soap into the bowl, the pepper flew to the edges. To Violet, it was magic. Of course, I knew better. What caused the pepper to run from the soap was surface tension, which really is kind of what's going on here. I drive around to the parish house on Wall Street. Immediately I see Edison, standing lookout, but no Ruth. I get out of my car, feeling my heart sink. Is she... He points across the lot, to where Ruth is standing on the sidewalk, looking at the foot traffic across the street. So far, nobody has noticed her, but it's a risk. I go to drag her back, touching her arm, but she shakes me off. I would like a moment, she says formally. I back off. Students and professors pass, their collars turned up against the wind. A bicycle whizzes by, and then the dinosaur bulk of a bus sighs at the curb, belching out a few passengers before moving away again. I keep having these thoughts, Ruth says. You know, all weekend long. How many more times will I get to take the bus? Or cook breakfast? Is this the last time I'll write out a check for my electricity bill? Would I have paid more attention last April when the daffodils first came up, if I'd known I wasn't going to see them again? She takes a step toward a line of adolescent trees planted in a neat row. Her hands wrap around one narrow trunk as if she's throttling it. And she turns her face to the bare branches overhead. Look at that sky, Ruth says. It's the kind of blue you find in tubes of oil paint. Like color, boiled down to its essence. Then she turns to me. How long does it take to forget this? I put my arm around her shoulders. She's shaking, and I know it has nothing to do with the temperature. If I have anything to say about it, I tell her, you'll never find out.
Ruth. When Edison was little, I always knew when he was getting up to no good. I could sense it, even if I couldn't see it. I've got eyes in the back of my head, I would tell him, when he was amazed that even if I turned away, I knew he was trying to steal a snack before dinner. Maybe that is why, even though I am facing forward like Kennedy told me to, I can feel the stares of everyone sitting behind me in the gallery. They feel like pinpricks, arrows, tiny bug bites. It takes all my concentration not to slap at the back of my neck, swat them away. Who am I kidding? It takes all my concentration not to stand up and run down the aisle and out of this courtroom. Kennedy and Howard are bent together, deep in a strategy session. They don't have time to talk me down from the ledge. The judge has made it clear that he won't tolerate disruption from the gallery and that he has a zero-tolerance policy. First strike, you're out. Certainly that is keeping the white supremacists in check. But they are not the only ones whose eyes are boring into me. There are a whole host of black people, many faces I recognized from my mother's funeral, who have come to lift me up on their prayers. Directly behind me are Edison and Adisa. They are holding hands on the armrest between their seats. I can feel the strength of that bond, like a force field. I listen to their breathing. All of a sudden, I'm back in the hospital doing what I did best. My hand on the shoulder of a woman in labor, and my eyes on the screen that monitors her vitals. Inhale, I'd order. Exhale. Deep breath in, deep breath out. And sure enough, the tension would leach out of her. Without that strain, progress could be made. It's time to take my own advice. I draw in all the air I can, nostrils flaring, breathing so deeply I envision the vacuum I create, the walls bending inward. My lungs swell in my chest, full to bursting. For a second I hold time still, and then I let go. Odette Lawton does not make eye contact with me. She is completely focused on the jury. She is one of them. Even the distance she puts between herself and the defense table is a way of reminding the people who will decide my fate that she and I have nothing in common, no matter what they see when they look at our skin. "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury," she says, "the case you are about to hear is horrible and tragic. Turk and Brittany Bauer were, like many of us, excited to become parents. In fact, the best day of their lives was October 2nd, 2015. On that day, their son Davis was born. She rests her hand on the rail of the jury box. Unlike all parents, however, the Bowers have some personal preferences that led them to feel uncomfortable with an African-American nurse caring for their child. You may not like what they believe, you may not agree with them, but you cannot deny their just due as patients in the hospital to make decisions about the medical care of their baby. Exercising that privilege, Turk Bauer requested that only certain nurses attend to his infant. The defendant was not one of them. And ladies and gentlemen, that was a slight she could not stomach. If I weren't so terrified, I would laugh. That's it? That's the way Odette glossed over the racism that led to that damn post-it note on the file? It's almost impressive, the way she so neatly flipped it so that before the jury got a glance at the ugliness, they were looking at something else entirely. Patients' rights. I glance at Kennedy, and she shrugs the tiniest bit. I told you so. On Saturday morning, little Davis Bauer was taken to the nursery for his circumcision. The defendant was alone in that room when the baby went into distress. So what did she do? Odette hesitates. Nothing. This nurse with over 20 years of experience, this woman who had taken an oath to administer care as best she could, just stood there. Turning, she points to me. The defendant stood there, and she watched that baby struggle to breathe, and she let that baby die. Now I can feel the jury picking me over. Jackals at carrion. Some of them seem curious. Some stare with revulsion. It makes me want to crawl under the defense table, take a shower. But then I feel Kennedy squeeze my hand where it rests on my lap, and I lift my chin. Do not let them see you sweat, she'd said. Ruth Jefferson's behavior was wanton, reckless, and intentional. Ruth Jefferson is a murderer. Hearing the word leveled at me, even though I have been expecting it, still takes me by surprise. I try to build a levee against the shock of it by picturing in quick succession all the babies I have held in my arms, the first touch they've had for comfort in this world. The evidence will show that the defendant stood there doing nothing while that infant fought for his life. When other medical professionals came in and prodded her into action, she used more force than was necessary and violated all the professional standards of care. She was so violent to this little baby boy that you will see the bruising in his autopsy photos. She faces the jury once more. We have all had our feelings hurt, ladies and gentlemen, Odette says. But even if you don't feel that a choice was made correctly, even if you find it a moral affront, you don't retaliate. You don't cause harm to an innocent to get back at the person who's wronged you. And yet, this is exactly what the defendant did. Had she acted in accordance with her training as a medical professional, instead of being motivated by rage and retaliation, Davis Bauer would be alive today. But with Ruth Jefferson on the job, she looks me square in the eye. That baby didn't stand a chance. Beside me, Kennedy rises smoothly. She walks toward the jury, her heels clicking on the tile floor. The prosecutor, she says, will have you believe this case is black and white, but not in the way that you think. I'm representing Ruth Jefferson. She is a graduate of SUNY Plattsburgh who went on to get a nursing degree at Yale. She has practiced as a labor and delivery nurse for over 20 years in the state of Connecticut. She was married to Wesley Jefferson, who died overseas serving in our military. By herself, she raised a son, Edison, an honor student who was applying to college. Ruth Jefferson is not a monster, ladies and gentlemen. She is a good mother, she was a good wife, and she is an exemplary nurse. She crosses back to the defense table and puts her hand on my shoulder. The evidence is going to show that one day a baby died during Ruth's shift. Not just any baby, though. The infant was the child of Turk Bauer, a man who hated her because of her skin color. And what happened? When the baby died, he went to the police and blamed Ruth. In spite of the fact that the pediatrician, who you will hear from, commended Ruth for the way she fought to save that infant during his respiratory arrest. In spite of the fact that Ruth's boss, who you will hear from, told Ruth not to touch this child when the hospital had no right to tell her to abandon her duty as a nurse. Kennedy walks toward the jury again. Here's what the evidence will show. Ruth was confronted with an impossible situation. Should she follow the orders of her supervisor and the misguided wishes of the baby's parents? Or should she do whatever she possibly could to save his life? Ms. Lawton said that this case was tragic, and she is right. But again, not for the reason you think. Because nothing Ruth Jefferson did or didn't do would have made a difference for little Davis Bauer. What the Bowers and the hospital did not know at the time is that the baby had a life-threatening condition that had gone unidentified. And it wouldn't have mattered if it were Ruth in the room with him or Florence Nightingale. There is simply no way Davis Bauer would have survived. She spreads her hands. A concession. The prosecutor would have you believe that the reason we are here today is negligence. But it was not Ruth who was inattentive. It was the hospital and the state lab, which failed to promptly flag a severe medical condition in the infant that, if diagnosed sooner, might have saved his life. The prosecutor would have you believe that the reason we are here today is rage and retaliation. That's true. But it's not Ruth who was consumed by anger. It was Turk and Brittany Bauer, who, lost in grief and pain, wanted to find a scapegoat. If they could not have their son alive and healthy, they wanted someone else to suffer. And so they targeted Ruth Jefferson. She looks at the jury. There has already been one innocent victim. I urge you to prevent there being a second. I haven't seen Corinne in months. She looks older, and there are circles under her eyes. I wonder if she is with the same boyfriend, if she's been ill, what crisis has overtaken her life lately. I remember how when we got salads down in the cafeteria and ate them in the break room, she would give me her tomatoes and I would pass over my olives. If the past few months have taught me anything, it's that friendship is a smokescreen. The people you think are solid turn out to be mirrors and light. And then you look down and realize there are others you took for granted, those who are your foundation. A year ago, I would have told you that Corinne and I were close, but that turned out to be proximity instead of connection. We were default acquaintances, buying each other Christmas gifts and going out for tapas on Thursday nights, not because we had so much in common, but because we worked so hard and so long that it was easier to continue our shorthand conversation than to branch out and teach someone else the language. Odette asks Corinne to give her name, her address. Then she asks, "Are you employed?" From the witness stand, Corinne makes eye contact with me, and then her gaze slides away. "Yes, at Mercy West Haven Hospital. Do you know the defendant in this matter?" "Yes," Corinne admits. "I do." But she doesn't. Not really. She never did. To be fair, I guess, I didn't really know who I was either. "How long have you known her?" Odette asks.
7 years.
We worked together as nurses on the L&D ward. "I see," the prosecutor says. "Were you both working on October 2nd, 2015?
"Yes.
We started our shift at 7 a.m. "Did you care for Davis Bauer that morning?"
"Yes," Corinne says,
"but I took over for Ruth."
"Why?"
"Our supervisor, Marie Malone, asked me to." Odette makes a big to-do about entering a certified copy of the medical record into evidence. "I'd like to refer you to Exhibit 24 in front of you. Can you tell the jury what it is?"
"A medical records folder," Corinne explains. "Davis Bauer was the patient."
"Is there a note in the front of the file?"
"Yes," Corinne says, and she reads it aloud. "No African-American personnel to care for this patient." Each word is a bullet.
"As a result of this, the patient was reassigned from the defendant to you, correct?"
"Yes."
"Did you observe Ruth's reaction to that note?" Odette asks.
"I did. She was angry and upset. She told me that Marie had taken her off the case because she's black, and I said that didn't sound like Marie, you know, like there must have been something more going on. She didn't want to hear it. She said, 'That baby means nothing to me,' and then she stormed off."
stormed off? I went down the staircase instead of taking the elevator. It is remarkable how events and truths can be reshaped, like wax that sat too long in the sun. There is no such thing as a fact. There is only how you saw the fact in a given moment, how you reported the fact, how your brain processed that fact. There is no extrication of the storyteller from the story. Was Davis Bauer a healthy baby? The prosecutor continues. It seemed that way, Corinne admits. I mean, he wasn't nursing a lot, but that wasn't particularly significant. Lots of babies are logy at first. Were you at work on Friday, October 3rd? Yes, Corinne says. Was Ruth? No. She wasn't supposed to come in at all. I'm pretty sure we were short-handed and she got pulled in to do a double, 7 p.m. running straight into Saturday. So you were Davis's nurse all day Friday? Yes. Did you perform any routine procedures on the infant? Corinne nods. At around 2:30, I did the heel stick. It's a standard blood test. It wasn't done because the baby was sick or anything. All newborns get it, and it goes off to the state lab for analysis. Did you have any concerns about your patient that day? He was still having trouble latching on for breastfeeding, but again, that's not extraordinary for a first-time mom and a newborn. She smiles at the jury. Blind leading the blind and all that. Did you have any conversation with the defendant about Davis Bauer when she came on shift? No. In fact, she seemed to ignore him completely. It's like an out-of-body experience, sitting right here in plain sight, hearing these people discuss me as if I'm not present. When did you next see Ruth? Well, she was on duty when I came back on shift at 7 a.m. She'd pulled an all-nighter and was scheduled to leave at 11 a.m. What happened that morning? Odette asks. The baby was being circumcised. Usually the parents don't like to see that happen in front of them, so we take the infant to the nursery. We give them a bit of sweeties, basically sugar water, to calm them down a little, and then the pediatrician does the procedure. When I wheeled in the bassinet, Ruth was waiting in the nursery. It had been a crazy morning, and she was taking a breather. Did the circumcision go as planned? Yes, no complications. The protocol is to monitor the baby for 90 minutes to make sure there's no bleeding or any other sort of issue. Is that what you did? No, Corinne admits. I was called for an emergency C-section for one of my other patients. Our charge nurse, Marie, accompanied me to the OR, which is her job. That meant Ruth was the only nurse left on the floor. So I grabbed her and asked her to watch over Davis. She hesitates. You have to understand, we're a tiny hospital. We have a skeletal staff. And when a medical emergency happens, decisions are made quickly. Beside me, Howard scribbles a note. A stat C-section takes 20 minutes tops. I assumed I'd be back in the nursery before the infant even woke up. Did you have any concern about leaving Davis in Ruth's care? No, she says firmly. Ruth's the best nurse I've ever met. How long were you gone? Odette asks. Too long, Corinne says softly. By the time I got back, the baby was dead. The prosecutor turns to Kennedy. Your witness. Kennedy smiles at Corinne as she walks toward the witness stand. You say you've worked with Ruth for 7 years? Would you consider yourself friends? Corinne's eyes dart to me. Yes. Have you ever doubted her commitment to her career? No. She has pretty much been a role model for me. Were you in the nursery for any of the time that a medical intervention was taking place with Davis Bauer? No, Corinne says. I was with my other patient. So you didn't see Ruth take action? No. And, Kennedy adds, you didn't see Ruth not take action? No. She holds up a piece of paper Howard has passed to her. You stated, and I quote, when a medical emergency happens, decisions are made quickly. Do you remember saying that? Yes. Your stat C-section was a medical emergency, right? Yes. Wouldn't you also say that a newborn suffering a respiratory seizure qualifies as a medical emergency? Yes, of course. Were you aware that there was a note in the file that said Ruth was not to care for this baby? Objection, Odette says. That's not what the note said. Sustained, the judge pronounces. Ms. McQuarrie, rephrase.
Were you aware that there was a note in the file that said no African-American personnel could care for the baby?
Yes.
How many black nurses work in your department?
Just Ruth.
Were you aware when you grabbed Ruth to